It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Noah Adams. When electric and electronic devices were first introduced, the sales pitch was always that these new tools would be labor-saving, and most were. It was farewell to a lot of tedious and sometimes back-breaking jobs. And these days, so much of our lives are powered by big turbines far away. Now, reaction to that, reporter Jennifer Sharp got word of a small movement in the West, a loose collection of human power advocates, people trying to put a bit of elbow grease back into getting jobs done.
Lonnie Green, the inventor of the human-powered bulldozer, sat on his back porch in Grass Valley, California, explaining that all these button-activated conveniences we've gotten so used to are just making our bodies go soft.
Because we're so used to just pushing a button and making something happen or pulling a lever, and there's no effort. When you use human power or the bulldozer, you have to work to make something happen, but in the process of working, you're becoming stronger instead of weaker.
Because if you just let go of the blade, it'll just dig in and you'll stop.
All right, so you want to go like that, kind of light.
There, so that's your upper down. Yes. And down here is the shifter, but you probably don't need to shift.
I'm sitting in a lawn chair welded to a scrap metal frame with my feet out in front of me resting on pedals. But it's not the pedaling that's the hard part. It's having the arm strength to work the crank that lifts up the bulldozer's steel blade.
And now you have to kind of lift as you go, because if you just let go of the blade, it'll just dig in and you'll stop.
All right, so you want to go like that, kind of lightly on the ground?
Yeah.
After helping Green move a pile of dirt, I got into my car and headed west for San Jose, where I met self-proclaimed eco-nut and human power enthusiast David Butcher.
Come on out to the garage, and I'll show you what the morning starts with. This old dog back here is the one that I ride every morning.
He points to what looks like a primitive spinning bike with a 36-inch flywheel made out of a pine tabletop. He calls his invention the pedal-powered prime mover and has been using it to harvest his energy since the mid-70s.
So I jump up there and I start pedaling, and it's a little noisy. That meter reads out how many volts I'm making right now. I'm making about 8 volts.
Pedaling for an hour every morning, Butcher is able to power his laptop, transmit a webcast, and feed a bank of 13 electric car batteries the energy that runs the bulk of his home office for the day.
A lot of things run because of your money, or run all by themselves, or run because of somebody else. But when you charge something up, or when you run it directly, you're looking right at the energy that you're making. And it's a very tight connection.
One person who got inspired by Butcher's vision is Adam Bozell, founder of the Green Micro Gym in Portland, Oregon. Tackling two of his biggest concerns, obesity and global warming, he hardwired his stationary bikes and elliptical equipment to feed the energy generated on them back into the building.
When you're talking about human power, you're talking about more than just somebody exercising on a bike and that makes electricity. You're talking about humans taking control of their environment in every way possible.
You got to leave your Prius outside the club. You got to leave your Hummer outside the club.
Pedal-powered bike rapper Fossil Fool, also known as Paul Friedman, is out on the steps of San Francisco's Academy of Sciences. Seeing human power as a tool for community building, his company, Rock the Bike, sells what might make a good mascot for the human power movement, a pedal-powered bike blender called the Fender Blender.
Almost everyone that buys it, the first thing that they want to do with it is they want to take it out into their community and share a sweet, thick, bike-blended smoothie.
But to Albert Hartman, founder of High Tide Associates in Silicon Valley, human power isn't about lifestyle choices, it's about survival. His company was hired by the military to design a hand-cranked battery charger.
The scenario that they were interested in was a dismounted soldier that was carrying everything on their back in their rucksack. And so they were interested in something that was about a pound.
He says the military is so reliant on human power, they research every and any new technology they hear about, no matter how far-fetched.
I heard of somebody trying to implant a turbine, a little propeller, inside somebody's vein. And the idea was that as the blood rushes by this little thing, it would turn on a little generator and make electricity.
With consumer electronics getting smaller and more conducive to a mobile lifestyle, Hartman sees the everyday person as becoming increasingly similar to a special forces operative.
If you got stuck out in public lands going four-wheeling or something, are you getting an airdrop every 24 hours? I don't think so.
This fall, Hartman plans to unveil the Roller Gen, a pedal-powered consumer version of his military charger that will snap onto the back wheel of any bike and fuel up a battery. He hopes the Roller Gen will make its way into off-grid villages in the developing world, whose low-watt power needs, mostly cell phones and LED reading lights, are now within the reach of human power. As for my human power harvest,
a little more. Try to stay above 12.
When I climbed onto David Butcher's pedal-powered Prime Mover, I was able to simultaneously run two cell phones, an electric razor, and charge up one of those labor-saving robot vacuum cleaners, the Roomba.
Okay, here comes the Roomba. Ready? And it's on.
As my energy propelled the Roomba across the driveway and vacuumed up the cement, I looked at it and thought, now that's progress.
Could you feel anything?
A little bit. It's harder. Oh, definitely. I feel it in my quad.
You've got to pedal a little harder. Your voltage is dropping.
Oh.
For NPR News, I'm Jennifer Sharp.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The Hubble Space Telescope has been orbiting Earth for 19 years, and it's working better than ever. That's what NASA officials said today. They were releasing the first images taken by Hubble after astronauts refurbished it. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce has the story.
The Hubble Space Telescope has been upgraded 5 times in space. The most recent mission almost didn't happen. It was canceled after the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster. NASA officials felt going to Hubble again might be too risky. But astronomers fought the decision, hoping to keep Hubble alive. And in the end, the mission went forward in May. Astronauts did 5 tricky spacewalks. They installed a new camera, added a fancy new spectrograph, plus fixed 2 other instruments. Ed Weiler heads up NASA's Science Mission Directorate. He says after the mission was over, he kept hearing one question.
When are we going to see the pictures? We know we've had successful spacewalks, but when will we see the pictures?
Today, at a press conference at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C., a music video featuring colorful new pictures flashed on a screen. Faraway galaxies, a nebula shaped like a butterfly, and a densely packed star cluster. After a summer testing and calibrating the telescope, scientists say Hubble is now more powerful than ever before. Heidi Hamel works at the Space Science Institute in Boulder, Colorado.
We in the community are already starting to get our data, and we're giddy with the quality of the data that we have with this new telescope.
David LaCrone is senior project scientist for Hubble at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. He says with the new and improved Hubble, the backgrounds of images are full of interesting detail.
You can already see remarkable differences between what we're seeing now and what we saw the prior instrumentation, just in this ability to see, look what's in the background. My goodness, I didn't realize that was there.
He says plans for future observations include studying objects like Pluto at the edge of our solar system and analyzing the atmospheres of planets around other stars. The astronauts who did all these fixes last spring say they were amazed by the new pictures. Mike Massimino says when they closed up Hubble for the last time and came home, they thought the mission had gone well.
And so it's really great to see the evidence that it actually does work, and those images just look great. And I am so grateful that it's working and that I didn't break anything.
NASA has no plans to repair Hubble again. The hope is that it will continue working until at least 2014. That's when the agency plans to launch the James Webb Space Telescope, a new large space observatory. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
And you can see that nebula shaped like a butterfly and more Hubble images at npr.org.
I'm Ira Flatow. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. Have you seen these new ads on TV? There's a cell phone ad in particular with teens trying to stop their parents from incessantly texting and tweeting. It's sort of interesting because we think that it's the young people who are texting and especially tweeting, but it's not just for young folks anymore. And that's really the result of a new study that came out this week about just who is online, who is using these social communities, what are they doing? I mean, there are some people we don't want to know about, you know who I'm talking about, who you meet socially online, but who are the people, where do they hang out, and what can we expect about the future? And that's actually the subject of this new study that came out this week. And joining me now to talk about it is Sean Cochran. He is an analyst for Forrester Research in Boston, author of The Broad Reach of Social Technologies. And he joins us by phone today. Welcome.
Thanks, Ira.
I was surprised to read in your study that but it reflects what we see on Science Friday about how much older people who are Twittering are than we might think.
Yeah, well, I mean, Twitter is an interesting tool in itself, but one of the things, the point of the research we did is we've been tracking this for about 2 years now, and what we found is now we're at the point where about four-fifths of Americans who are online are actually now participating in some form of social media, and a lot of that's been fueled by the growth of people over the age of 35. Some of that's through Twitter. I think Facebook has probably really been the biggest catalyst of it, though.
We've heard rumors that, online sort of rumors on the internet, that Facebook is losing participants in droves. Is that correct?
I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, the data I've seen is they're still at 250 million people globally. I haven't seen that kind of data yet specifically for them. But, I mean, if you look at Facebook, they almost have nowhere to go to some degree, because if they were a country population-wise at this point globally, they would be number four behind China, India, and the United States. So they're at a point now where they have a great deal of people. So it's a matter, I think, now of fixing, or not fixing, but improving their experience and really starting to make money is probably their focus.
Yeah. And number four in the whole world.
I mean, the United States is at a little over 300 million now, and they'd be at 250 million. So, yeah, they'd be ahead of, I think, Indonesia would be the next biggest. So, 30% of their usage comes from the United States. And you're looking at the numbers that they have, I mean, it's pretty amazing the amount of people are still using. I mean, before you start talking about them losing people, I think you have to look at how many people are actually using it now. I think that's still a big news factor. 250 million people using it globally, half of them roughly are logging in on a daily basis. So, there's people are spending more than 5 billion minutes a day on Facebook. So that kind of activity shows that it's still doing fine, I think.
Is that the largest place anybody is congregating?
It's hard to say. I mean, you could say that, some sites like Google and others have a lot of traffic, but people are spending more time, I think, Facebook than really any other social network, that's for sure.
Right. Well, people can Twitter to us, as they do every week, at SciFri, that's at SCIFRI, and also our number, 1-800-989-8255. Now, these people, what are they doing? I noticed in your report you've broken it down to creators, collectors, spectators, joiners, critics, inactives. Lurkers.
We created groupings based on activity and really what we call the social technographics ladder. And it really, starting at the bottom, there are people who are just inactive. They're not included at all. Now, that group is down to as low as 18%. So only 18% of Americans who use the Internet don't use social tools in some way. And then we started to look at what's the most basic way you could get involved, and that's a spectator, someone who just, is online, maybe reading a blog or watching videos on YouTube that people have uploaded. Then there's the joiners, which is now half of the Americans that use the Internet on a monthly basis have actually joined a social network of some kind at this point. And then we got into other things like collectors and critics, people who tag things and organize things are collectors, people who do ratings and reviews are critics. And then finally at the apex, we have creators. And at this point, about a quarter of Americans who use the Internet are actually a creator now. So that shows you how many people are actually out there publishing and creating information. That has a lot of impact on a lot of different industries. I mean, I cover marketing very specifically, so the advertising world's very, very different now, and also journalism. And, seeing what happens with the newspapers, you're seeing a lot of citizen journalists now.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I have some teenagers who I use as my gut checks on these things. And very few of them actually use Twitter. They love Facebook, but they're still doing mostly the old IMing text messaging.
Sure, and that's actually, that makes sense. If you look at the nature of kind of the beast that Twitter is, and Twitter's kind of an odd, counterintuitive tool. I don't know how often you use it, but I think a lot of people that use it still trying to figure it out. Yeah. But there has been some data that's been released. Now Twitter's grown so fast, it's kind of hard to really pinpoint some of this stuff. From one hand, it had about just a few million users in 2008. It's up to between 20 and 40 million, depending on who you talk to, this year. Mm-hmm. So to be able to even get a grasp on what is happening on Twitter is kind of difficult. Initially, it was more kind of adults, I guess, 25 to 44 type-year-old people that were using Twitter. There is some data lately from a company called Comscore that just came out recently, I think in the last week or so, that 18 to 24-year-olds are one of their fastest-growing segments. Mm. So younger people are moving in there. But Twitter's really kind of a broadcast tool. It's a little bit more public than Facebook. It's an easier place to control. It's a little more private. And if you think about a teenager, for instance, a teenager is someone whose social network is usually right around them, within their school or, you know, right around them, pretty close to them. So using things like, you know, a cell phone or, you know, for mobile texting or, you know, your Facebook to kind of share your experiences makes sense. But when you get into an older age, and I think a lot of us know this, you know, in your career, you start to build a network across the country, across the globe even, and you want to update those people pretty regularly, or you want to follow people that have something to say. And that's really what's brought some of the younger people into Twitter, is that, you know, people like Miley Cyrus and Britney Spears and Ashton Kutcher are regularly updating, and people are coming in to kind of hear what they're saying on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Do different demographics, different age groups find different social media they prefer?
Definitely. One of the things that Facebook's, you know, found is that women over the age of 35 have kind of flocked there, and they've certainly done that. And Twitter originally had a little bit more of a male twist at the beginning. You know, and then you look at MySpace, which is still around, still has 50 million people using it, but it's definitely for a much younger audience and focus a little bit more towards entertainment. So people definitely have, based on age, and you know, you can break it down by demographics, a lot of things have ways in which they use these tools very differently. And people's lives are different, so that's the way they do it. There are different life stages. And, you know, as you get a little older, I think people over the age of 35 have found Facebook really great, because you can connect with people you haven't seen in a long time, and you can, you know, you can kind of see what's going on in their life. But it's a very personal thing. And then you have people using something like LinkedIn. It's really more for career, you know, professionals. And I use it personally as my kind of like my virtual Rolodex. I just keep all the people who I feel like I need to keep in touch with from a career perspective in there.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to John in Berkeley. Hi, John. John, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, quickly.
Yes, I just called myself a Facebook widower. My wife comes home and she jumps on the computer and on Facebook, and I have to beg her or fight with her to get a greeting out of her. And when I talk to her about it, and it's Twitter now also, we're both in our late 30s, she basically sees what she does on there as very, very important, even though, you know, 6 months ago or a year ago, it wasn't even important in her life.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
All right. Thanks for dropping out there. Yeah, we heard that about Second Life when Second Life first started.
Yeah, we call it Second Life, and we have this term in the industry, we call it the shiny object syndrome, where people tend to flock towards something, and they try it out, and if they like it, they stay. If they don't, they drop off. And, you know, Second Life, really, it still has a decent amount of people visiting it, but it's just not the same. I don't think Facebook's at that point. I think Facebook's well beyond that now. I mean, like I said, the amount of people using it, the amount of people time they're spending, you know, some of the other statistics you can throw out there. I mean, there's over a billion photos uploaded to Facebook in a given month. I mean, people are using it as almost, you know, their personal address book in a sense.
Well, that's what I was going to say. If you want to reach people as an advertiser or somebody, do you now go to Facebook instead of creating your own web page?
I mean, to some degree you do. I mean, and that's actually a great point, because it's one of the things we talk about with marketers now is, you know, marketers for years now, for decades, have been used to what we call shouting. It's this idea that, you know, advertising is talk at. You know, you just throw a message out there, and if they hear it, great. But now people have the ability to talk back, and talk back even more than you think. And it's very transparent to everyone else when they do talk back. So what we tell, you know, marketers is that basically you need to start building relationships with people. And, yes, you know, you'll have your website still, but you're going to have a presence in all these places where people live as well.
Mm-hmm. And so do you find one person? Let's say you want to find people on Facebook. How do you reach all those people? If there are 250 million people.
Well, I mean, some of it's just Facebook, and, you know, there is ways to search within the Facebook, and it works pretty well. I mean, the way I usually do it is if I meet someone, and my personal rule is I only allow someone in my Facebook if I've met them and have a friendship with them. So
you mean face-to-face?
Yeah, usually, or unless it's someone I spend a lot of time with work-wise, maybe I don't see that much. Right. They work on the West Coast or in Asia or something.
So you don't want 1,000 of friends, quote-unquote, friends on
And that's
your
what I use Twitter and LinkedIn for. So I actually use it in different ways.
So you've decided where the limits are for each one.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the nature of each one. Facebook, the way it works is when you build your profile, you have to accept a friend, and a lot of those things that happen in there are very personal. So the things on my Facebook profile, for instance, are who my wife is and who my friends are, and pictures of my life, and I don't necessarily need to share that with everyone. But Twitter, on the other hand, is kind of interesting because that's my way of my kind of like my megaphone out to the world on things I'm talking about. And the,
So which are your core social communities that you live in?
Me personally, it's the three that I talked about: Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn.
LinkedIn.
Yep.
And each one, LinkedIn for business?
LinkedIn for business only. It's, like I said, it's like a virtual Rolodex. It plays a little bit more of a role than that.
There's something new that Google is coming out with, is the Wave. You know anything about that?
I'm not as familiar with that. I mean, they have this thing called Latitude that they came out, which you're able to kind of track your friends through your mobile phone with Google Maps, which is a little bit different. But, you know, everybody's trying to come up with something in this space.
Mm-hmm. And you got to be careful where you go and what you say on these places, because once you hit that return button.
Yeah, especially in Twitter, sometimes you can't get that stuff back. I mean, that's one of the things that's really broadcast out to a lot of people. And if people choose to follow you, they're going to hear what you're saying. So you do have to be careful. And then, there's always security issues. And I think these companies like Facebook have done a nice job of increasing the security and making it better, but yet people should realize that when they they place things on out there, it's on someone else's server and lives out there somewhere else.
If you go on a picnic with somebody and they take your picture,
It
could end up out there, and people you don't want to see could see you on that picnic.
And we said 24% of people are now creators, so everyone's kind of a publisher in some way.
And you think everyone sooner or later will be participating, even though they may be a lurker now.
Yeah, I mean, everyone, it's almost impossible to avoid it at this point. I think social tools, the ability to share is just another dimension, another aspect of the way we communicate.
All right, Sean, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thanks, Ira. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Sean Corcoran is an analyst for Forrester Research in Boston. He's author of the new report, The Broad Reach of Social Technologies, and very interesting stuff about Twitter. You can Twitter us. Our Twitter is at SCIFRI. Also, we're in Second Life. People are grouping there and listening to the program. You can send us email there or our number 1-800-989-8255, the old tell way. So stay with us. We'll switch gears and come back and talk about, what's happening to the swine flu in college campuses around the country and what you should be aware of. So stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News.
Going to the movies used to require commitment. You had to go to the theater, buy a ticket, find a seat among the masses. Well, that was before the VCR, the DVD player, before mail-order movies, before streaming. So to talk about how we'll be watching movies in the coming years, we've turned to Reed Hastings. He's CEO of Netflix. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're running a business in which you expect one of your main products, the DVD, to be obsolete sometime soon. How do you do that?
Well, it's all depending on your definition of soon. So we think DVD is continuing to grow for the next couple years. But you're absolutely right. In the next 10 or 20 years, all the consumers will be streaming movies over the internet.
Talk to me a little bit more about the streaming, because I have to tell you, I have a Netflix queue with maybe 20 movies in my list. And if on a given night I decide I want to see something that's at the bottom of that list, I will often go to stream that movie and find that neither it nor any of the next 10 items on my Netflix queue are available for streaming.
When we look at streaming, the thing to remember is that televisions over the next 10 or 20 years will be increasingly Wi-Fi equipped. And what we're going to find is web browsers built into televisions so that then from your laptop and from your television, you'll be able to view essentially any movie. Now, right now, there's only a few televisions that are so equipped, and there's only a few titles that are available.
What keeps more titles from being available?
Mostly the economics. As the number of streaming users grow, then we're able to pay for more and more movies. So the more users we get, the more content that we can get, which again attracts more users.
I see.
When we buy a DVD, we can buy it from Walmart, we can buy it from Costco, we can buy it from the studio, and we can rent it. But in streaming, you do individual deals with each content owner. There's movie studios, there's also television networks. But for each content producer, we have to do an individual deal with that content producer for that piece of content.
Well, how far off do you think the day is when whatever somebody might want on their Netflix queue might also be available for live streaming?
Oh, I think we're on a trajectory over probably 10 years to have nearly everything on streaming, and not just Netflix, but other firms also, and also to have Wi-Fi built into every television over 10 years.
So what comes next after streaming that I may not be thinking of, but you are?
Oh, that's like the little crystal chip that someone implants in your ear and has every piece of music and video ever recorded. And if you ever think about a song, then you owe the record companies a penny.
I'll get movies projected onto my retinas?
Exactly.
How long do you think until I can get a Netflix streaming movie on my mobile phone?
That may be a few years, because we're still focused on the televisions. And for us, the laptop and the television are the two biggest screens, and then comes mobile. So it's definitely in the pipeline, but not in the short term.
You've put a lot of emphasis on user recommendations. You have the Netflix Prize, where you offer $1 million to a computer programmer who can come up with the best algorithm to recommend movies that a user will like. Why the emphasis on this particular aspect of the experience?
For most people, when they watch movies, maybe one in four movies that they see, they absolutely love, they rave about. And what we're trying to do is make it easier and easier to choose so that then it becomes one out of three and one out of two and maybe someday two out of three of the movies that you watch, you just rave about.
What's your favorite way to watch a movie?
A favorite way to watch a movie? I'd have to say I'm still biased to the movie theater.
Really?
There's nothing like, you know, going to the theater and being, especially for comedies and, you know, the whole audience laughing.
Reed Hastings is CEO of Netflix. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne. Where is Waldo? If you know, the Moat Marine Laboratory is looking for him. Waldo is the lab's underwater robot. It was investigating red tides off Florida's coast last week when it vanished. Waldo cost about $100,000. The Marine Lab hopes someone among all those Labor Day boaters might spot its missing machine. And there's a $500 reward for Waldo's return. It's Morning Edition.
For a man whose workday involves watching lots of movies, Bob might be interested in hearing about this.
Sony brings 3D home in 2010.
Sony is one of several companies that plan to launch a 3D TV at home early next year. And the new TV sets are rolling out in Berlin as we speak. That's the site of one of the world's biggest gadget shows. It's called the Internationale Funkausstellung, or IFA for short. And it's a venue for tech companies to show off their best new inventions for the fall and beyond. Erica Aug is there. She's a reporter for CNET.com, and she joins me from the convention hall. Welcome to the program.
Hi, great to be here.
When the convention is over on Wednesday, what's the one gadget you think everyone's going to be talking about?
As you mentioned, I definitely think that people are going to be talking about the fact that a lot of these companies here want us to watch 3D in our own living rooms rather than in the theater.
What do you think? I mean, are they pretty cool?
Yeah, I think that it adequately mimics the experience of the theater, obviously on a smaller scale. But the drawback is you still do have to wear those funky plastic glasses that you wear in the theater. And I have to say that I don't know that everybody would necessarily want to do that whenever they wanted to watch, you know, a movie at home.
So I'm also hearing, Erica, about the boom in netbooks. These are of course these cheaper, lower priced versions of laptops. What are you seeing out there?
There were two netbooks that were launched here at the show that we'll see soon, and one of them is the Sony Vaio X series, which is really thin. It's got a 10-inch screen, and it's only maybe an inch thick. And actually, you know, when you go over and you pick it up and you kind of move it around, it's actually almost bends. And so that might sound like it's not a good idea, but I think the flexibility is going to be really good for, you know, people taking it a lot of places in their purse or in their briefcase or that kind of thing. And the other one, there was a Samsung netbook that's just as thin, that's just as small a screen, very mobile, but that one is claiming to have an 11-hour battery, which is a long time for any computer.
I know in the past there have been some sort of weird things that have been introduced at this convention, because I've been there before. For example, electronic lederhosen with iPod controls. Have you seen anything like that this time around?
I haven't seen anything quite that funny. But I did happen to walk by a booth, and I saw two cell phones sitting in a an aquarium, a fish tank.
And a fish tank.
Yeah. Basically, they're advertising this very rugged phone that's supposed to survive a lot of different conditions, you know, like extreme hot, extreme cold. And apparently, being dunked in a fish tank or some body of water.
Are you seeing any products that, you know, you would, like, expect to see in the Jetsons?
One of the really cool things are these organic light-emitting diode TVs, or OLED for short. Sony right now is the only company that actually makes one. They're very, very, very thin. I think they're 0.1 inches thin.
0.1 inches thin?
Yes.
Wow.
And as a result, they're very expensive to make. And so the one that Sony sells is only an 11-inch display, which, you know, is smaller than you and I would probably want to watch our television programs on. But LG has one here at the show, which is 15 inches. So while that doesn't seem like it's that much bigger, it actually is progress.
Well, what makes that TV better?
The organic light-emitting diodes are incredibly thin, which is what allows it to be such a tiny screen. And it's really energy efficient. And it also produces the most amazing picture you'd have ever seen on a television.
Erica Ogg reports for CNET.com. And she joined us from the floor of the IFA Electronics Show in Berlin. Erica, thanks so much.
Sure thing.